treasure, unbelievable riches. He could not believe the contents of the survival pack. The night before, he was so numb with exhaustion, he couldn't do anything but sleep. All day in the water had tired him so much that, in the end, he'd fallen asleep sitting against his shelter wall, oblivious even to the mosquitoes, to the night, to anything. But with false gray dawn, he'd awakened instantly and began to dig in the pack to find amazing, wonderful things. There was a sleeping bag, which he hung to dry over the shelter roof on the outside, and a foam sleeping pad, an aluminum cook set with four little pots and two frying pans. It actually even had a fork and knife and spoon, a waterproof container with matches and two small butane lighters, a sheath knife with a compass in the handle, as if a compass would help him, he thought, smiling. A first aid kit with bandages and tubes of antiseptic paste and small scissors, a cap that said CESSNA across the front in large letters. Why a cap, he wondered. It was adjustable, and he put it on immediately. A fishing kit with four coils of line, a dozen small lures and hooks and sinkers. Incredible wealth. It was like all the holidays in the world, all the birthdays there were. He sat in the sun by the doorway where he'd dropped the night before and pulled the presents, as he thought of them, out one at a time to examine them, turn them in the light, touch them and feel them with his hands and eyes. Something that at first puzzled him. He pulled out what seemed to be the broken off, bulky stock of a rifle that he was going to put aside, and he was going to put it aside, thinking it might be for something else in the pack. But when he shook it, it rattled. After working at it a moment, he found the butt of the stock came off, and inside there was a barrel and a magazine and an action assembly with a clip and a full box of 50 shells. It was a .22 survival rifle. He'd seen one once in the sporting goods store where he went for bike parts, and the barrel screwed onto the stock. He'd never owned a rifle, never fired one, but had seen them on television, of course, and after a few moments, figured out how to put it together by screwing the action onto the stock, how to load it, and put the clip full of bullets into the action. It was a strange feeling, holding the rifle. It somehow removed him from everything around him. Without the rifle, he had to fit in, be part of it all, to understand it, and use it. The woods, all of it. With the rifle, suddenly, he didn't have to know, did not have to be afraid or understand. He didn't have to get close to a fool bird to kill it, didn't have to know how it would stand if he didn't look at it and moved off to the side. The rifle changed him. The minute he picked it up, and he wasn't sure he liked the change very much, he set it aside, leaning it carefully against the wall. He could deal with that feeling later. The fire was out, and he used a butane lighter and piece of birch bark with small twigs to get another one started, marveling at how easy it was, but feeling again that the lighter somehow removed him from where he was, what he had to know. With a ready flame, he didn't have to know how to make a spark nest or how to feed the new flames to make them grow. As with the rifle, he wasn't sure he liked the change. Up and down, he thought. The pack was wonderful, but it gave him up and down feelings. With the fire going and sending up black smoke and a steady roar from a pitch-smelling chunk he put on, he turned once more to the pack. Rummaging through the food packets, he hadn't brought them out yet because he wanted to save them until last, glory in them, he came up with a small electronic device completely encased in a plastic bag. At first, he thought it was a radio or cassette player, and he had a surge of hope because he missed music, missed sounds, missed hearing another voice. But when he opened the plastic and took the thing out and turned it over, he could see that it wasn't a receiver at all. There was a coil of wire held together on the side by tape, and it sprung into a 3-foot-long antenna when he took the tape off. No speaker, no lights, just a small switch at the top and the bottom he finally found in small print. Emergency transmitter. That was it. He turned the switch back and forth a few times, but nothing happened. He couldn't even hear static. So, as with the rifle, he set it against the wall and went back to the bag. It was probably ruined in the crash, he thought. 2 bars of soap. He'd bathed regularly in the lake, but not with soap, and he thought how wonderful it would be to wash his hair, thick with grime, smoke, and dirt, frizzed by wind and sun, matted with fish and foulbert grease. His hair had grown and stuck and tangled and grown until it was a clumped mess on his head. He could use the scissors from the first aid kit to cut it off, then wash it with soap. And then, finally, the food. It was all freeze-dried and in such quantity that he thought, with this I could live forever. Package after package he took out. Beef dinner with potatoes, cheese and noodle dinners, chicken dinners, egg and potato breakfasts, fruit mixes, drink mixes, dessert mixes, more dinners and breakfasts than he could count easily. Dozens and dozens of them, all packed in waterproof bags, all in perfect shape. And when he had them all out and laid against the wall in stacks, he couldn't stand it, and he went through it again. If I'm careful, he thought, they'll last as long as I need them to last. If I'm careful. No, not yet. I won't be careful just yet. First, I'm going to have a feast. Right here and now, I'm going to cook up a feast and eat until I drop, and then I'll be careful. He went into the food packs once more and selected what he wanted for his first feast, a 4-person beef and potato dinner with orange drink for an appetizer and something called a peach whip for dessert. Just add water, it said on the packages, and cook for a 30 minutes or so until everything was normal size and done. Brian went to the lake and got water in one of the aluminum pots and came back to the fire. Just that amazed him. To be able to carry water to the fire in a pot. Such a simple act, and he hadn't been able to do it for almost 2 months. He guessed at the amounts and put the beef dinner and peach dessert onto a boil, then went back to the lake and brought water to mix with the orange drink. It was sweet and tangy, almost too sweet, but so good that he didn't drink it fast. Held it to his mouth and let the taste go over his tongue. Tickling on the sides, sloshing it back and forth, and then down, swallow, then another. That, he thought, that is just fine. Just fine. He got more lake water and mixed another one and drank it fast, then a third one. And he sat with that near the fire, but looking across the lake, thinking how rich the smell was from the cooking beef dinner. There was garlic in it, and some other spices, and the smells came up to him and made him think of home, his mother cooking, the rich smells of the kitchen. And at that precise instant, with his mind full of home and the smell from the food filling him, the plane appeared. He had only a moment of warning. There was a tiny drone, but as before, it didn't register. Suddenly, roaring over his head, low and in back of the ridge, a bush plane with floats fairly exploded into his life. It passed directly over him, very low, tipped a wing sharply over the tail of the crashed plane in the lake, cut power, glided down the long part of the L of the lake, and then turned and glided back, touching the water gently once, twice, and settling with a spray to a taxi and stop with its floats gently bumping the beach in front of Brian's shelter. He had not moved. It had all happened so fast that he hadn't moved. He sat with the pot of orange drink still in his hand, staring at the plane, not quite understanding it yet, not quite knowing yet that it was over. The pilot cut the engine, opened the door, and got out, balanced and stepped forward on the float to hop onto the sand without getting his feet wet. He was wearing sunglasses, and he took them off to stare at Brian. "I heard your emergency transmitter. Then I saw the plane when I came over." He trailed off, cocked his head, studying Brian. "Damn, you're him, aren't you? You're that kid. They quit looking. A month? No, almost 2 months ago. You're him, aren't you? You're that kid." Brian was standing now, but still silent, still holding the drink. His tongue seemed to be stuck to the roof of his mouth, and his throat didn't work right. He looked at the pilot in the plane and down at himself, dirty and ragged, burned and lean and tough, and he coughed to clear his throat. "My name is Brian Robeson," he said. Then he saw that his stew was done. The peach whip was almost done, and he waved to it with his hand. "Would you like something to eat?"